Earlier in the program, I said that you and I are karmically connected. We've been brought together at this moment by an incredible synchronicity, an amazing conspiracy of improbabilities. And that karmic connection is also the foundation of all relationships in your life. Everyone you love and everyone you meet, and even everyone you talk with on the telephone. So what should you do now that you find yourself in this absolutely magical set of circumstances? There's no other word for it. It's magical. Your life is magical. If we put our attention on it all the time, we'd experience all of life as one miracle after another. Synchrodestiny just accelerates the miracles and raises our awareness of them. A meaningful coincidence is simply a miracle that happens very fast, so that you can recognize it. Let me make a practical suggestion for integrating the miraculous into your life. Think about meaning, about the meaning of meaning. Where does meaning come from? What is the role of meaning? Who gives meaning to a certain event or relationship or circumstance? What's the connection between meaning and the many different kinds of omens that suddenly materialize in your life, the seeming improbabilities? But remember, they're only seeming improbabilities. Actually, every omen, every clue is a coded message from the universe itself. Our task is to decode those messages. Our task is to discover their meaning and follow wherever the meaning leads us. The code that the universe uses is metaphor. This is how meaning comes to us. It comes to us disguised by metaphor. The universe itself is a metaphor. The physical body is a metaphor. My voice is a metaphor. Niels Bohr once said, "All reality is a symbol." That's a beautiful sentence. All reality is a symbol. The real reality is the universe and consciousness. The man dressed up as Mickey Mouse is a symbol of the real Mickey Mouse, which existed before the man put on the suit, and which is in no way affected when he takes it off. The real Mickey is the idea of Mickey. If you study the operation of the nervous system, if you learn how the brain operates, you'll see that the brain does not give meaning to anything. The human nervous system does not give meaning to anything. The human nervous system is simply a transducer, a mechanism that changes one form of energy into another. Suppose you have mechanical energy and you want to change it to electrical energy. What really has to happen? Or if you want to make chemical energy out of electrical energy. Science is now realizing that in the end, there's only one energy, and we are constantly seeing its transformation, constantly seeing it disguised in various ways, seeing it cloaked in different metaphors. Every time I talk to you on the phone, I'm converting mechanical energy into electrical energy. But what I'm really changing is the energy's disguise. I'm shifting it from one metaphor to another. If I'm talking on a cellular phone, I'm changing the energy's disguise from mechanical energy to microwave. And then it's changed back into mechanical energy on the other end of the call. The brain is also a transducer. It can convert one form of energy into another. So right now, as I'm speaking to you, what I'm doing is converting my thoughts, because thoughts don't originate in the form of energy. Thoughts are in the realm of information. But they become energy somewhere in my nervous system, and this happens instantaneously. As soon as you have a thought, then it becomes a form of energy, an electrical impulse in your nervous system. That electrical impulse goes to your vocal cords and stimulates a vibration. That's what sound is. Your voice is just a vibration of your breath. Breath is the movement of consciousness. Breath in itself is simply the vibration of the atmosphere. So there's a vibration in your throat when you speak, and then the atmosphere starts to vibrate. And what happens when someone hears you? The person's eardrum picks up the vibration. It converts the vibrations into an electrical impulse, which travels along the auditory nerve and goes to a part of the brain called the auditory cortex. And there the electrical impulse is converted into a neurotransmitter, and the person suddenly understands what you're saying. That's very scientific, but it's also magical. Because what really happened? Mechanical energy into electrical energy into chemical energy. And somehow, out of all of that, meaning emerges. But where does the meaning really come from? Who gave these words meaning? We may know what a word means, but do we really know how a word means? Scientists have thought about this. Philosophers have thought about it. And there's been a realization that meaning does not come from the nervous system. Meaning comes from the user of the nervous system. Don't mistake the user of the instrument with the instrument. When I look at the moon through a telescope, I'm not the telescope. I'm using the telescope to look at the craters on the moon. All that instrument does is convert one form of energy into another. When I do something, when I pick up a pencil or draw a circle, my brain orders my muscles to move. If you could somehow look into my brain's activity, it would be sending messages to the nerves to move my hand. But before that, someone or something has to order the brain to order the muscles to move in that direction. So who gives the order to the brain? Both the meaning as well as action come from a source which is beyond the brain. And that source is what we call the soul. The soul is in the gap between our thoughts. It just uses the brain to interpret and to make choices. It's not inside the brain in a physical or chemical form. And it's not in the body either. The soul only uses the brain and the body to express itself. So an out-of-body experience is the real experience. An in-body experience is the real illusion. But we are very accustomed to that illusion. We think the illusion is us. It's an understandable error. It's as if you talked on the phone 24 hours a day. You might think you've become the phone. So the soul is not in the body. It uses the body. It's so used to using it all the time that it starts to think it is the body. When you're in a room, you give shape to a particular space. You create a wall and a roof and a door and a couple of windows. So if the wall is destroyed and the roof is destroyed, you would probably assume that the room itself has been destroyed. But the room isn't destroyed, because the room is the space, not the shape you've given it. And you can't destroy that space, or for that matter, any space. The analogy is exactly the same with the soul. The soul is the space from where thoughts come from, where interpretations and meanings are given, where action is generated. It's not the body, even though the soul is using the body. The body gives the soul boundaries, but the soul itself is unbounded, just like space is unbounded. My colleague, Dr. David Simon, is the medical director at the Chopra Center for Well-Being. He had an experience that illustrates this point very well. Dr. Simon is a neurologist and an internist, and when he completed his internal medicine training, he interviewed with neurology programs around the country. He met with the chairman of the Department of Neurology at the University of Colorado, Dr. James Austin, a man who happened to have a very deep interest in spirituality and meditation. So Dr. Austin asked David why he wanted to become a neurologist. David said, "Well, I wanted to see if there was some way that I could better understand consciousness by looking at the body and the nervous system." So Dr. Austin said, "You know, last year I was at the Zen monastery in Japan, and I said something very similar to my Zen teacher. And my teacher told me that trying to look at the soul by looking at the brain was like trying to figure out the personality of a person living in a house by looking at the automobile engine in a car parked out in front of the house. Actually, maybe you can learn something about the person who lives in the house by looking at the engine of his car. And to some extent, that's what we've been doing throughout this program. I said at the outset that there are only two symptoms of enlightenment according to Vedic teachings. one symptom is you stop worrying. Worries just disappear from your life. And the other symptom is that more and more synchronicities start to happen. There's something paradoxical about this, because when you encounter more synchronicities, you become more enlightened. And when you become more enlightened, you encounter more synchronicities. It's a paradox, a tautology. It's like a Zen koan. The whole process is something you might not even recognize until you're ready. It's a spiritual process, a spiritual evolution, a transformation. I'm acquainted with a woman who's a professor at a very prestigious university. She's an extremely rational person, and she's used to analyzing historical and social issues in material terms. She's an economist and a sociologist, and certainly not a mystic. But recently she had an experience that was outside the boundaries of anything that had happened to her before. She had a friend, another professor, who died of cancer at a very early age. And after her friend died, she found herself in a friend's house, helping to pack up her belongings. She looked at the books on the bookshelf, and she realized that these were exactly the same books that she herself had read when she was in college. For some reason, this made a tremendous impression on her. So that night, she told her husband, "I had this incredible coincidence happen today." And he said, "What was it?" And she said, "Well, I was in my friend's house helping to pack up her books, and I realized they were the same books I read when I was in college." And he just looked at her and said, "Why is that such a coincidence? You're a sociologist, and she was a sociologist. You both had the same training, you both took the same courses, so you both read the same books." And of course, she had to agree with this on some level. But at the same time, something else had definitely happened. This woman was about 40 years old. When she was 6 years old, if you put her in a room with a friend who just died, and she saw they had the same books or toys, she might have been made very sad, or perhaps very frightened. There would have been a strong emotional reaction. And if she was 14 or 15, she might have reacted very much the way her husband did. That's a very adolescent kind of rationalism. Adolescents love to see through things. They love to cut through sentimentality. Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye is a great example of an adolescent point of view. Holden is always detecting phonies. That's what teenagers love to do. But now you take this very intelligent woman who's 40 years old, and she sees that she and her friend read the same books, and suddenly she interprets it in a completely different way than she would have at other points in her life. She doesn't react emotionally the way she would have as a child, and she doesn't react rationally the way she would have as an adolescent. All of a sudden, she reacts spiritually. All of a sudden, she doesn't see a ghost, nor does she see a dry statistical probability. She sees a meaningful coincidence, a synchronicity. Somehow, she had just arrived at that point. I hope you're experiencing that kind of evolution in your own life. And as you experience it, as your awareness grows, what can you expect to happen? Well, a lot of things. You'll feel a connection with everything that exists around you. You'll become more loving, more compassionate, more connected, more forgiving, more tolerant, more generous, more everything. You'll stop worrying. You'll encounter more synchronicities. But it's very important to realize how all of that is a byproduct of your moving toward transformation rather than a means of doing so. Enlightenment is a result of entering a universal domain of your own awareness. It's a result. It's not the means. People say, "Well, I want to achieve enlightenment, so starting today, I will definitely become more loving, more compassionate, more forgiving, and then I'll see the light." That's a very basic misunderstanding, I think, in all religions. The idea that if you do good things, then you'll have a good soul. It really doesn't work that way. What does Christ say? seek first the kingdom of heaven, and all else will be added unto you. So seek first your own domain of awareness, and then enlightenment occurs as a byproduct. You don't try to turn on the light in the dark room. You just look up one day and the light is on. So it's important to understand how synchrodestiny cannot be forced, how you've got to focus on the process for its own sake rather than on the outcome. But with that in mind, let's briefly review the 7 principles of synchrodestiny, because when you understand them and truly take them to heart, you can shape the phenomenon and give direction to coincidence. The first principle is the existence of the conscious energy field. The material world is an expression of the conscious energy field, and as inhabitants of the material world, we are also expressions of the field. Moreover, we remain always in touch with the field. We can influence the field through our thoughts and hopes and dreams. When we learn to use this power wisely, we can manifest our desires in the conscious energy field, because it is truly a field of infinite possibilities. The second principle is that the conscious energy field is understood through relationships and is driven by relationships. Everything that arises out of the field exists in the form of a relationship, and every relationship can influence the field. That's why I've referred to relationships as cosmic connections. In a sense, relationships are a language that the field understands, and human relationships are the language to which it's most attentive. So every human relationship is really an opportunity to influence the field positively, because every relationship is an opportunity for spiritual evolution. For this reason, there are no bad relationships. There are pleasant relationships and unpleasant ones. And there are easy ones and difficult ones, but there are virtually no relationships that are simply bad. The third principle pertains to the phenomenon of inner dialogue. We're always conversing with someone or something in our minds, and the content of that inner dialogue influences every area of our lives, physical, emotional, and spiritual. There are basically 2 categories of inner dialogue. One which is spirit-based and another which is dominated by ego needs. Spirit-based inner dialogue connects us to the conscious energy field and to other human beings. Ego-based inner dialogue isolates us. The fourth principle concerns the power of intention. Although it's difficult to quantify or demonstrate experimentally, intention is an extremely important focus in the universe. In fact, the universe itself has intentions. It operates teleologically, the way an oak tree grows from an acorn. Human consciousness is an expression of the universe's intention to think about itself, and ultimately, to understand itself. As human consciousness evolves and transforms, the intention of the universe towards self-understanding will be fulfilled. The fifth principle is the role of emotional turbulence. All sorts of distractions are continuously inserting themselves into our consciousness. The character of these distractions is karmically significant. In other words, the kind of emotional turbulence we experience is determined by the conditioning we've undergone throughout our lives, and even in the prior conditioning we inherited at our birth. To change or eliminate emotional turbulence, we have to break the cycle of action, memory, and desire that is our karma. So emotional turbulence is a barrier to synchronicity, but it also points the way toward what needs to be done. Emotional turbulence is like an alarm clock that can awaken us from the passive slumber of our karmic conditioning. We may not like the sound of the alarm clock, but if it wakes us up and we turn it off, then it has served its purpose. The sixth principle describes the conspiracy of improbabilities. An improbability is an event that contradicts statistical likelihood. And when such an improbability occurs, it is always karmically significant. It is always an opportunity for growth and transformation. By paying attention to these improbabilities and following where they lead, we can discover a conspiracy of improbabilities working in our favor. The seventh and final principle concerns the masculine and feminine energies that animate the universe by their harmonious interaction. This is what I refer to as the cosmic dance. One of the most important steps toward transformation involves integrating the male principle and the female principle in our own being. The principles are not really in contradiction, but there is a tendency in human consciousness to favor one over the other. Most of us don't embrace both of them. In our society, masculine energies such as power, physical strength, and the force of will tend to overshadow female qualities of intuition and conciliation. But when we learn to embrace both these principles, spiritual transformation is nurtured, freedom of awareness is nurtured, the seed of ecstasy is planted. In the previous session, we spoke of two paths as ways of participating in the cosmic dance, two ways of achieving the ecstatic experience. The first was physical ecstasy that derives its power from sensual or sexual experience. The second was mythological ecstasy that helps you see past your everyday concerns and into the realm of magical possibilities. The last kind of ecstasy is sacred ecstasy, which is direct experience of spirit or God, or whatever word you prefer. It's the ecstasy that comes from experiencing what God experiences, or at least as much of that as is possible in this incarnation. But can we really know what God experiences? If we answer in the negative, this will represent a huge departure from the whole history of human consciousness, because humanity has always tried to envision its gods or its God in terms of recognizable human wants and needs. The gods are happy, or the gods get angry, or the gods fall in love. Of course, the visions of God have taken drastically different forms, even contradictory forms. The Aztec goddess Cuauhtlicue wore a necklace made of skulls. She wanted human sacrifice. The Greek goddess Aphrodite wanted something different. She wanted every living thing to fall in love with her. Christ also wanted to spread love, but a different kind of love than Aphrodite. Agape, not Eros. Spiritual love, rather than sensual love. So our gods have always acted upon human impulses that people could identify with. Impulses that people could feel in themselves. Right now, to conclude this program, I want to suggest another godlike attribute, another way that God expresses himself or herself, and I think you'll see that it has great relevance to our subject of synchrodestiny. For the next few moments, I'll ask you to think of God not as a warrior or a beautiful woman or a wise man with a beard, but as a storyteller, and I'll explain how you can participate in the cosmic dance by realizing that you're a character in one of God's stories. Not his only story by any means, but a story that is being created just for you. One of the most interesting investigators of human consciousness is a professor at Northwestern University named Roger Shank. He's worked for many years in artificial intelligence and other areas of research, but his current interest is in how people learn. Shank believes that people learn from stories by listening to them and by creating them. Telling stories, hearing stories, those are basic human impulses. According to Professor Shank, we learn everything from stories. Even where there doesn't seem to be a story involved, there's a fundamental process whereby you create a story in order to take in information. If a grade school student is learning the multiplication tables, he really does it by creating a story that will exist in his memory. He'll remember the numbers within the context of a narrative. He'll remember the story of reciting the tables in front of the fourth grade class, or being drilled on the tables by his sister one night after dinner. As the years pass and the student grows up, he won't have to access the whole narrative every time he multiplies 9 by 6, but the story will always be there, and it can be remembered very quickly. Professor Shank has created some very imaginative applications for the story-based theory of learning and teaching. There's a computer-based training system for corporate employees in which mistakes aren't indicated by flashing lights or loud buzzers. Instead, the face of a kindly-looking older man appears on the screen. He looks like the uncle everybody would want to have, and he actually tells a story about the kind of mistake the trainee just made. It has a setting, characters, and a brief plot, and it plants itself in the employer's memory in a very vivid way. In a recent magazine article, Roger Shank was quoted as saying, "Communication involves the mutual exchange of stories. We keep track of complicated information by shaping it in our minds as narrative." The Nobel Prize-winning author Isaac Singer once said that God is a novelist. He likes to write thrillers and melodramas. He likes to write page-turners. And he's really good at it, because very few people want to get to the last page. So this is how I'd like you to think of God for just a moment, as a novelist and a storyteller. You don't have to use the word God. You can think of the universe or the cosmos. The universe tells us a story, and if we pay attention, we can learn from that story. We can be transformed by it. The cosmic storyteller likes complicated plots, and synchronicity is perhaps the storyteller's most powerful device for creating twists and turns. But remember, the twists and turns aren't there for their own sake. Their purpose is to teach. The story comes into being so that you can learn the meaning of spiritual transformation. The purpose of the story of your life, is to help you achieve a higher level of consciousness, to help you manifest abundance in every sense of the word. And what happens when you do achieve that higher level? Well, many things happen. But one of the most important is that you are able to help create the story yourself. That's the difference between synchronicity and synchrodestiny. Synchronicity is a plot device intended to get your attention. Synchrodestiny means your attention has been engaged, your energy has been activated, and now you're not just a character anymore. Now you're collaborating with the author of the book. What's it like to collaborate with the author? Well, let's find out. In this final exercise of the program, which will last for a few minutes, I would like you to create the story of your life, from where you are now to wherever you choose for the story to end. In other words, I'll ask you to see your life as God sees it. And by composing the story, perhaps you can share a little of what God experiences as he or she weaves the plot around you. So please choose a time and a place where you're not likely to be disturbed. And we'll begin this exercise with a brief meditation. Just have your awareness in your breathing, or you can also use a mantra if you prefer. Now imagine that you're somehow looking down at yourself from a great height. The fact that there is a roof over your head in no way impedes the view. You can see right through the roof. You can see yourself sitting there with your eyes closed. Who is this person that you see? What are the themes in this person's story? Who are the characters that are close to this person? Who are the friends? Who are the lovers? Who are the enemies? How did this person come to be sitting in this chair at this precise moment in time? What incredible twists and turns of plot have come down to this? What were the grandest surprises? What were the most crushing disappointments? What has been learned? What has been missed? Think about the plot of your life up to this point. Behind the twists and turns, there's an intention for you to learn something. But what? No one can tell you, because no one but you knows the story. But there's something it's intending to teach you. What is it? Think about it. Now, time to create the rest of the story. Where do you see yourself going when you open your eyes and stand up from your chair? What surprises can you imagine for yourself during the rest of this day, or this week, or this year? Remember, you're creating the plot of your own life, so make it good. Put in plenty of meaningful coincidence, and remember too that the ultimate purpose of the story is to teach. What do you want to learn? What do you need to learn? Over the next few minutes, create the story of your life as you would like to live it, not just in a superficial sense, but in a way that transforms you into the person you want to be. Please open your eyes and please be aware of the amazing opportunity that now awaits you. Please be aware that everything you just did in your imagination can also be done in the material world. Synchrodestiny is both an explanation of that fact and the power to make it happen. All it takes is one thing. All that's required for you is to recognize the great power, the supreme power that's within your grasp.
This is the end of side 16.